Senate State and Federal Affairs Committee, February 16, 1967. To be heard today, Senate Bill 129 modifies existing.
August 9. We should open our RC Director's Firm's preliminary draft number 2 and have that in front of us. That will help us.
The tab says PD number 2.
Yeah. Discussion and set it for as a preliminary draft number two. Now, please note we've changed that here. And then we went on to subsection 1 of section 1 concerning the building. And Mr. Collette explained that Justice Sloan of the previous meeting objected to the use of other structure in the definition of building because it implied that a vehicle, boat, or aircraft is a structure. The definition in sub 1 had accordingly been amended to cure this objection. Mr. Chandler commented that the new definition appeared to limit vehicle, boat, or aircraft to those specifically adapted to overnight accommodation of a carry-on business area. Mr. Collette replied that the definition had not changed in that sense. The intent of the definition was to protect the type of property that would be likely to pay human beings for the purpose of first-degree arson prosecution, he said. Mr. Spaulding was bothered because we recalled the code of building. And Justice Sloan suggested that we substitute building by property. And Mr. Collette agreed that, or replied that when we've been working on the theft statute, they agreed that the property definition in the draft of the applicable sections other than the theft sections, that for this reason we have not identified property for the purpose of the arson prosecution section. And Justice Rodman had a question whether the definition of building in the preliminary draft is consistent with the definition of building here. Don replied that originally they've been consistent, but they're not now. Now, in that regard, Don, we're completely consistent. At this time,
yes.
Preliminary draft. Here's, I think, an important discussion. Mr. Fletch said the building definition posed a policy question as to the type of property the committee wanted to protect. Most frequently, they said moving arson to instances where people are likely to kill or injure. And to expand the definition of building to accomplish that purpose. After further discussion, the committee expressed agreement that the highest degree of proscription should be placed upon the person, one, setting fire to forest land, and two, setting fire to anything which endangers the life of another. Now, that was a policy determination that we made, and I'm assuming that in preliminary draft three, we carry that policy forward, yes, with respect to first degree. I asked Mr. Collette if it was his position that the proposed definition of building, particularly insofar as the building being adapted for overnight accommodation was concerned, did not narrow the present definition of dwelling house, and was told that the definition was broadened to include any kind of structure where people might lodge. Justice Rodman had an observation made with respect to the phrase, in addition to its ordinary meaning, indicating that it could apply to the barn or outbuilding. And I brought a problem. Maybe we ought to just leave the arson statute the way it is. And Mr. Fletcher suggested that it might be more important to emphasize protection of forests than oriented protection of other valuable property in addition to human life. And contended that if some conduct could be covered adequately by another provision, there was no legitimate purpose served by calling an act arson unless the use of fire had some other result. That resulted in the danger of damaging a building or a body of another by fire. He called attention to the fact that the draft provided that if a person burned property with a motive to collect insurance, the result thereof caused any of the consequences listed in subsection 2 of section 4 or section 5, crime would be arson. Without those consequences, the act could be prosecuted for fraud, theft, etc. discussion? Then Mr. Spaulding has a suggestion with respect to changing the definition of building. And I asked if the general articles would contain a definition of building, and Don said they would. Now, have you reached that
yet? No, I said I didn't think they would.
Oh, yeah, you didn't think they would, right. Some discussion as to whether definition of building is available in the car. And Mr. Spaulding had a suggestion of changing some wording in that. If you want to pick it up from there, Don, stick along, maybe you can go faster than me.
Okay, down to the last paragraph, page 4. Justice Sloan suggested that we just delete the definition section from the draft, and that we should just have Parsons refer to property defined in the general articles. What I was trying to say was that it wasn't. I didn't think that would be satisfactory because just because property was destroyed by fire did not necessarily make it arson. Unless you had either injury or threatened injury to a person or damage or threatened damage to a building. I didn't like the model penal approach when a person was guilty of the highest degree of arson and intended to damage property by a fire or explosion, whether or not actual damage occurred. In other words, I was providing for, in order to make first degree arson, there had to be actual damage rather than just intent. New York, Michigan, Connecticut have all rejected the model penal code approach on that and have required that actual damage. Then on page 5, I find out we're trying to broaden the definition of building. It's pretty repetitious, but I have not written into the sections on first degree arson the limitations that were included in the New York Commission. Namely, that under both of those versions, it was only first degree arson if there was intentional damage to a building by fire, and further, that another person who was not a participant in the crime was in such building at the time of the fire, and the defendant knew that fact or should have known it. Those versions seem to include too many elements, and the subcommittee agreed at its previous meeting this approach would place too great a burden upon the prosecution when prosecuting first degree arson. By using the same definition employed in the other drafts, it was brought too far since the Oregon draft did not require the prosecutor to prove that there was someone actually in the building. And the draft now inadvertently referred to the burning of a building or a barn or something that might not ever contain people. The point raised by Judge Rodman said that in addition to its ordinary meaning, it would include buildings which would not have people in them with a valid objection. And the definition required amendment because this phrase would include non-dwelling type buildings. The committee were all phrased in addition to the ordinary meaning should be deleted. And we talked about carrying on business. We're going to include teaching schools and difference of opinion on that. And Mr. Spaulding pointed out the traditional concept was to include buildings adapted for overnight accommodations and suggested that occupancy of persons for any purpose might substituted in the building definition. When business buildings were included in the definition, he said the draft was given away from the overnight concept. Mr. Flett noted that if someone died in the fire, it would be felony murder. Justice Sloan suggested that if property included building, it was unnecessary to define building. He thought it would be better to express what arson was intended to mean, was what it was limited to, and what it included as an expression of intent rather than try to define building. The thing that should be expressed, he said, was the act that was socially reprehensible enough should be granted arson. Judge Rodman then said that if Justice Sloan's suggestions were followed, subsection 1 of section 1 would be deleted. Subsection 1 of section 5 would be deleted. And subsection 2 of section 5 would define property as that customary occupied by the people. Subsection 2 would then read any property, whether it is owned or another's, customary occupied fact is occupied and such act recklessly causes bodily injury to another person or damage to a building of another. Mr. Paulette explained that the reason for retaining subsection 2 of section 5 was to cover the crime of arson to collect insurance where the actor intended to burn his own property, but as a result injured someone or burned someone else's property. The subcommittee had decided that if he burned his own property and no other property was damaged, the crime should not be arson just because insurance was involved. Chairman Burns indicated that the committee had not discussed the departure from the present code where intentionally was employed rather than willfully, wantonly, or maliciously. He observed that it's harder to prove the act was done intentionally than to prove it was done wantonly or maliciously. Mr. Flood replied that the words of intent or purpose had not yet been defined. The drafting had proceeded on the assumption that those definitions would generally follow the definitions of the modern code. Then on Judge Rodman's someone who damaged property not ordinarily occupied by others, but which did in fact cause bodily injury. The actor intentionally set fire to something that didn't fit the description in section 5.2. He could not be tried for first degree arson. Then Dave Meade said that it was a question of whether the important element was the intent of the actor or the end result. He expressed the view that it was not as reprehensible to burn a building which the actor believed to be unoccupied, even though someone was injured, as it was to burn it when he knew there was someone in the building. Mr. Flood replied that the committee was most concerned with what the defendant should have known rather than what was actually brought about by his conduct and suggested the amendment would probably suffice. Chairman Burns was of the opinion that requiring that he knew the building was occupied as an element of proof would cause problems. And he asked if it could be argued that the actor didn't intentionally burn down the house, that he had intentionally burned his own car and recklessly placed the house next door in danger. Mr. Flood pointed out that such a situation, he would have consciously disregarded a risk that he should have known existed and recklessly would cover the act. Justice Sloan agreed that recklessly would include knowledge that the danger existed and suggested the deletion of or damage to a building of another in section 5.2. Mr. Spaulding commented that the person should be guilty of first degree arson even though no one was injured. If the burning could have injured the person, Chairman Burns expressed agreement. He added, however, that the actor could not be charged with first-degree arson in that situation if the draft was premised upon actual injury to a person. Mr. Spaulding suggested the draft say, quote, if the act is designed to place another person in danger. He said, a person should not be convicted of first-degree arson if the burning happened to place another person in danger for unexpected reasons. Chairman Burns said he believed burning of the Capitol building should be arson to the highest degree, not necessarily because people were present, but because of the class of property. Then we took a recess, and then Judge Rodman talked about his suggested amendment, deleting subsection 1 and section 1 and adding in sections 4 and 5 after the word building the phrase, quote, customarily occupied by people, unquote, or as an alternative, subsection 1 and section 1 be amended to read, quote, building is a structured vehicle, boat, or aircraft customarily occupied by people. The reference to, quote, adapted for overnight accommodations, quote, be deleted. Then we talked about section 2, negligent burning, reckless burning, section 3. Mr. Spaulding urged deletion of accidentally from subsection 2, section 2, because he was of the opinion that the prosecution shouldn't have to prove that the act was done accidentally. Then I explained that the subcommittee had recommended at the previous meeting that the provisions of ORS 1640703 be incorporated and intentionally be deleted in subsection 1 because there was some question as to whether the draft on reckless burning would cover the kind of negligent conduct prohibited under the present statute. Subsection 2 was intended to cover that situation wherein someone accidentally started a fire on land of another. And we talked about some of the Oregon cases. My graph, I can substitute the word reasonable for possible with relation to the effort that the actors have to make to control the fire. And the courts have interpreted that to mean that reasonable efforts, so I saw no point using possible.
They interpreted possible to use,
right? Right. That's further discussion, Mr. Spaulding moved that negligibly be deleted from the introductory paragraph of section 2 and inserted as the first word in subsection 1, which would then read negligibly failed to fire to escape.
He objected because he thought this was too hard, because the person could do everything possible to prevent a fire to escape, and he'd still be liable if it did escape, unless it will change as he suggested. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Now let's see, we talked about section 2, sub 2, with respect to accidentally starting the fire on one another. And Justice Sloan wanted to know what happened if a man intentionally started the fire on land which he believed it would be his own, but through inadvertence he didn't know precisely where the property line was, started the fire on land of his neighbor. And I replied that his duty to put the fire out began when he became aware that the fire was on his own land. He added that there were several cases holding that there was no such duty to the person to become aware of the existence of the fire. Chairman Burns pointed out that 16407.04 contains provisions that was admitted to this act, which reads, having knowledge of the fire burning on one's own land or land that was heated in possession or control, and failing to or neglecting to make every possible effort to extinguish the same, regardless of whether or not one is responsible for the starting or existence thereof. Mr. Follett responded that the subcommittee had directed him to delete from preliminary draft number 1 the language intentionally starting a fire or causing an explosion. Chairman Burns asked if, by omitting this provision, the draft reached a situation where someone deliberately set a grass fire that did not imperil a building, person, or forest line. Mr. Follett answered that under the draft there would be some types of fires that might be intentionally set, but might not come within arson and would be covered under criminal mischief. Intentional damage of property of another by fire could be criminal mischief, he said. Then Mr. Spaulding suggested section 2 read, quote, a person commits a crime of negligent burning if he damages property of another by negligently starting the fire, failing to make every reasonable effort to put it out or control the fire. Mr. Flett pointed out that Mr. Spaulding's proposal would limit the actor's duties to put out or control the fire only to the situation where he started the fire. He explained that he had used permitting in the draft to cover situations where an actor might or might not have started the fire. Chairman Burns said he had no objection to section 2.1 as amended, but recommended that subsection 2 conform to 16407.03 by inserting a quote on one's own land after starting the fire. Explained he had admitted on one's own land and covered the promise he thought was covered under subsection 1, including the phrase at the end of the amendment. Chairman Burns expressed agreement and said he had no objection to subsection 2. Just inserting the equivalent of 16407.01 in the draft because that provision would cover intentional burning. Mr. Flood replied that when the phrase, quote, unlawfully setting on fire was used, many questions were raised as to why the act was unlawful. After further discussion, Mr. Spaulding moved, seconded by Chandler, that subsection 2 be amended to read, starting a fire on one's own land or the land of another and failing to make every reasonable effort to extinguish or control the fire. Explained that most was the result of the discussion that a man might intentionally burn his own stubble field, and that would be all right, but if he let it escape to cause damage to property of another and didn't use every reasonable effort to control it, he would then be guilty of negligent burning. Flett asked if he would not be guilty under subsection 1 under the same circumstances. Mr. Chandler asked if the drafter applied for man burned stubble on his own land and in so doing burned up a car belonging to a pheasant hunter which was sitting in the middle of his field. Mr. Flett pointed out that ORS 16407 covered fires on land and was not related to that question. There was nothing contained in that statute which was applicable to negligent burning someone's personal property. Noting the concern of the committee in its last meeting was that the situation in which there was an accident starting a fire was not covered under reckless burning. ORS 16407.0 had been incorporated in preliminary draft number 2, which specifically limited the act to accidentally starting a fire. fire. He contended that setting fire on one's own land would be covered under subsection 1 and would take care of the situation where it might have been accidental or might have been intentional. Chairman Burns suggested section 2 of the entitled Fire on Land or Burning on Land reads, a person commits a crime under this section if he damages property of another by 1, negligently permitting a fire to escape land under his custody or control, or 2, starting a fire on one's own land or the land of another, failing to make every reasonable effort to extinguish or control the fire, or 3, recklessly burning. He recommends a reference to explosion found in section 3 of the draft. Okay. I don't want to.
All right, take it from
there. Yeah,
I asked Justice Sloan if he thought there was a constitutional problem involved in saying that intentional damage to property by fire could be covered by the criminal mischief statutes. And Justice Sloan expressed a view that the constitutional problem might exist. He suggests a statement replaced the criminal mischief statute to indicate that it includes type of conduct not covered by the arson statute. I said that when type of arson is intended to be covered in another section of the code, such as criminal mischief, the commission was submitting the existence of a hole in the code to be construed by the courts, and I objected to this possibility, and Mr. Chandler agreed. Mr. Spaulding said he saw no point in requiring proof that a fire had actually damaged property of another under the negligent burning section. He was of the opinion that the section was more concerned with the public wrong and grave danger of permitting the fire to escape from land in the actor's custody or control, and was protecting a particular property. Mr. Webb responded, in such a course would create an inconsistency in that the balance of the draft when discussing intentional arson required damage. I think this is an important thing. He asked that if the committee wanted to say that for intentional arson there had to be damage, but for negligent fire it would be a crime without damage. Mr. Spaulding said that seemed consistent to him because there was an evil in letting fire get away without exerting every reasonable effort to keep it under control. Now, with respect to this question of damage, you all know that presently, as a matter of proof, there has to be evidence of charge for corpus delicti arson exists. I think this is kind of important. Read it again. He asked if the committee wanted to say for intentional arson there had to be damage, but for negligent fire it would be a crime without damage. Mr. Spaulding said that seemed consistent to him, because there was an evil in letting fire get away without exerting every reasonable effort to keep it under control. The chairman asked if the committee was agreeing the draft should contain a section on negligent burning, and all agreed that it was desirable. The chairman then asked if the committee also was agreeing that a section on reckless burning should be included, and Mr. Spaulding thought it was unnecessary, and Mr. Chandler commented that he was not sure that there was a sufficiently great difference between the two to require both sections. Fled observed that there was a higher degree of culpability under recklessness than under negligence. Fled noted that Michigan limited arson to buildings if somebody was likely to be injured on a particularly valuable property, and this appeared to be the direction in which most of the divisions were going. Justice Sloan commented that this theory ignored the fact that arson is perhaps the most hazardous kind of misconduct a person could engage in, and Mr. Fled that where the danger to persons did not exist, the fact standing alone that fire was used to accomplish the deed should not make the act a crime of arson. Let's read that again. Well, Mr. Fleck replied that where the danger to persons didn't exist, the fact standing alone that fire was used to accomplish the deed should not make the act a crime of arson. In other words, what Don is saying is that the arson proscription should be directed toward those crimes which endanger people, right?
Yeah, either that or the buildings, you know.
And of course, the fact that we have a reckless burning and a negligent burning section in the arson chapter is
not to confuse anybody into thinking that reckless burglary or negligent burglary are arson.
Yeah, and also in connection with the destruction of personal property by fire. The direction of the revision is to not call those crimes arson.
Call those
criminal destruction. Did you
then resolve a possible constitutional question as to that was related a moment ago in the interplay between Justice Lowe and myself?
Well, I have resolved to my satisfaction. I'm not so sure about her. As a matter of fact, I'm in the process of writing a memorandum on that very question because it has come up so many times that I thought it would be helpful to him, not just for arson purposes, but when we're talking about one crime, or one act that may or may not constitute more than one crime. Whether it's some constitutional question under Perky, I frankly don't think Perky applies in that situation. But the purpose of the question that was raised in this discussion, I don't think there is a constitutional question. The mere fact that a crime could be prosecuted under, because fire is involved, it can be prosecuted under something that is not arson. I think there are Oregon cases that bear that out.
We'll cite lead on criminal law when it comes up.
But I do have a memorandum that I'm about halfway through that I intend to distribute to the subcommittee to all of us on this question. There have been a number of cases that have come up since the Perky decision where similar questions have arisen. If you can be prosecuted under more than one statute,
I've got one on my desk right now involving a guy that shot his way out of a roadblock on this Oregon and shot over the policeman's head. And he claims he should have been prosecuted under maybe some pointing at a firearm.
He's got a fatal case.
Ontario.
Question of intent.
Yeah. Question of intent.
Well, I suppose this is probably something that comes up. I know that comes up frequently, but I feel that we should be absolutely sure in going about the revision that there wouldn't be any constitutional problem. We want to eliminate problems rather than create them.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, we're just about finishing off. Buzz on here because I don't know about the rest of you, but this has been.
I might say this area of I think that the federal courts at least are going away from this perfect idea that
equal protection.
Unless they can find an exact precise set of circumstances to apply to both cases, and they'll be limited to that by they won't go along with that argument.
You think you're going away from it?
I think so.
Well, really, don't you think the only time that you're going to have a perfect time question is going to be sustained in favor of the defendant is where you've got unbridled discretion on the part of the district attorney or the grand jury without any guidelines. In other words, they can call one act a crime or a misdemeanor without any type of simple act that either in their discretion. And I know whether they label the felony or a misdemeanor. That's what Perky is.
Yeah.
Or Perky is. Writing a check has been either a felony or a misdemeanor, depending on the way you've indicted for it.
Right.
Just going to reel this off and then have a little recess. Representative Elder commented that if Mr. Flint's argument was valid, arson in the first and second degree was all that was needed to be retained in the arson draft, and negligent and reckless burglary should be included in criminal mischief provisions. Mr. Spaulding agrees that just because somebody violated the law with fire should not be called arson. And then I suggested that the chapter be called arson and divided as follows. Section 1, definition. Section 2, arson in the third degree, including negligent. Reckless maximal burning. Section 3 arson, section 3, section 4 arson,
Yes, explain the overnight accommodation feature is included because of the concept that a dwelling house was a place where someone was likely to be asleep, and that concept had been broadened by the draft. Well, I added that the reason the overnight concept was bad was not so much that people were asleep, but because they lived there. Many agree the criterion for first degree arson should be occupancy of the building rather than adaptation for overnight lodging. The number one consideration should be danger to human life. Mr. Follett suggested the committee retain the concept that a building be defined to include things other than dwellings where there might be people. Building means any structure, vehicle, or place customarily occupied by persons lodging, carrying on business area, whether or not the person is actually present. And Mr. Spaulding urged that the proposed statute be written so everyone can understand it. When the statute said a building was a vehicle, it didn't make sense. He suggested the committee employ the phrase protected property instead of using building completely out of context. He suggested, quote, protected property means any structure, place, or thing customarily occupied by people are adapted for the business of carrying on business therein. And Justice Sloan asked why it's necessary to limit the definition to carry on a business, and Mr. Sloan acknowledged that the suggested definition is advised to carry or place after people. And Mr. Chairman proposed to go a step further and encompass the definition of forest land and public buildings. And as I understand it, that this is what you have in preliminary draft number 3. Then, Chairman, in his wisdom, said that first degree arson would then be intentional burning of any protected property, intentional burning of any property that caused bodily injury or damaged protected property, or the imperiling of life or limb. Second degree arson should be intentional burning of the property of a building not customarily occupied by people. That would include barns, railroad, cattle cars, and so forth. Mr. Spaulding suggested that to solve the problem of labeling reckless burning as arson, there should be a separate chapter entitled Reckless and Negligent Burning. Mr. Follett remarked the legislative council would in all probability codify the two subjects under one chapter, and Mr. Spaulding said in that event, heading should be crimes by fire or something similar. The chairman asked that the clerk excerpt this latter portion of the committee's deliberations and distribute a copy to each member who would in turn return individual critiques to Mr. Flair based upon the comments he received, and we'll all employ the company to receive to then prepare another draft. Okay, let's take a short recess.
The rest of the minutes are all about rock.
Yeah, this helped me a lot, and I think my resistance is worn down.
Well, now this preliminary draft number 3 is, as near as I can tell, incorporating all the suggestions that the committee agreed on in the last meeting.
Yeah. Now,
the protected property phraseology was always key to that, I think.
What's the basic difference between 3 and 3A in your own mind?
Well, I just used a little different type of definition of property rather than going into protected property, because it seemed to me that it might be a little awkward when we're talking about things that aren't protected property, and that perhaps the classification of which we classify like class 1 property or class 2 property. This was drafted by me not because anyone asked for it, but because it was just an alternative method of saying the same thing in case this further reflection, the subcommittee felt that they didn't like what we had before. But,
Now, starting right off the top, right at the end of the minutes, there was a suggestion by somebody that we entitle this Crimes by Fire, Arson. further away from the general section of being tagged in arson. That problem.
Well, I don't really think that's a problem. Because when we start putting this thing together in final form, these things are all going to be codified in one chapter anyway. I don't think what the chapter calls it is going to be important. I think what the statute calls it. So I just called it arson and related offenses, which is consistent with our earlier drafts where we talked about theft and related offenses. We talked about burglary and related offenses.
Well, in the present ORS, it's called arson, or it's entitled Crimes Involving Fire. That subcommittee does have an objection to the title, and I don't. Then, let me say this, starting right with Section 1, my first inclination is that your nomenclature in 3A, where you use Class 1 property and Class 2 property, is more precise, and we ought to adopt that. Do you have any feeling about that?
I already know. I'd like to hear what all due respect. I'd like to see what Spalding has to say about that. I already but that's really world of knowledge on this.
He has a good grasp of it.
And, doggone, it's too new to me to really have an opinion on it.
Well, if we can go ahead and make some recommendations and pass this out, and there is a question with respect to that, when we have the full committee meeting, it's going to be a simple enough technical change to make.
I was really of the opinion that this protected property really solved the problem. We finally hit on that at the end of the last meeting. And I guess you hadn't had time to reflect on it and I come up with any of it. I think it solved the problem for first degree. It's real simple to say, well, for first degree arson is protected property, but what about the others? And that's where when I started drafting this, it seemed to me, and as you'll look on page 2 of the preliminary draft, you get down to arson in second degree, and at least my feeling was, maybe there are things that I overlooked in drafting there, but it seemed to me that you have to draft it in the negative, which bothered me a little bit, rather than saying that this and this and this are the elements, you're saying this and this are elements, but this is not. I think it's an awkward way of drafting a criminal statute, but because we have to say a person commits the crime of arson in the second degree, intentionally damages any building of another that is not protected property. If he damages it and it's protected property, then it's easy to see that that's first degree.
Yeah.
But everything isn't going to be protected property because of our definition of that. And that's why I propose the alternative way of doing it, that is to classify it, Class 1, Class 2. Class 2 means the building is not customary. And although that's your definition includes a negative, still your definition of the elements of the crime.
Well, your choice of words in drawing second degree arson statute is much more precise. When you say a person intentionally damages Class 2 property, he's guilty of second degree arson, whereas alternatively you would have to say if a person intentionally damages property that is not protected property as defined by this chapter, then he's guilty of second degree arson. And I think, but we're really arguing about semantics and not substance. So if we could,
I wonder if that's it. Yeah, that's my real question.
But not in all candor, I should point this out too. Now, in with a certain amount of drafting license under preliminary draft number 3A, class 2 property includes forest land. So that under preliminary draft 3, forest land would be first degree arson, and under 3A it would not, it would be second degree.
Well, I wondered about that. Is that what we really want to do? In the minutes that we just read, we talked about forest land as being arson, as being a pretty heinous crime.
Well, except on page 11 of the minutes we just read, which was the last page that we, well, first of all, the last page, the bottom of the last sentence in the next to last paragraph. The committee agreed that the criterion for first degree arson should be occupancy of the building rather than adaptation for overnight lodging, and the number one consideration should be danger to a human life.
Yeah. And we also talked about, particularly at Chandler, Alaska and Washington, Oregon, this forest land thing is a pretty serious matter. And inherent in setting a forest fire is the likelihood that you're going to take human life.
Well, I'm not sure that it's inherent in it, Ann.
It's a very real danger.
I wasn't sure just where I'm going through the minutes, so I knew that this had been discussed, and it was my impression that everyone in the subcommittee was in agreement that intentionally setting a forest fire should be upgraded from what it is under our present
rule. Yeah.
Right. Whether or not
does this do it?
You wanted it first degree, or whether you felt second degree might be enough of a prohibition.
What are the penalties going to be?
We had in preliminary, we haven't attached any penalties to any of these yet. And we, of course, won't until the whole code is pulled together. But
are we getting back to when we say class one property means any structure, place, or thing customarily occupied by people, including public buildings? Are we getting back to Spaulding's objection and the Justice's objection that we're talking about boats and airplanes and things as structures?
Well, we have public building, Ed, is defined in ORS 479-01, and it's presently first degree arson. 479-010 reads. Means a building in which persons congregate for civic, political, educational, religious, social, or recreational purposes, including, among others, state buildings, courthouses, schools, colleges, libraries, museums, and civic buildings.
Are we going to leave that on the books?
Lecture halls, yes. I could read it at length.
We wouldn't be changing the law on that.
We would not be changing the law.
Changing that one. Okay.
No. It seems to me a highly desirable thing to include the burning of public buildings.
What does 479 cover?
It's a definitional section, Dave. Not related to arson.
But anyway, what we were basically spent a big portion of the last meeting talking about. Boats, airplanes, and
general definitions
as to whether they were structured or not, and were we just skirting reality in a sense by calling them structure?
Well, we get to
the arguments that John Allen about that. That we finally came up with a decision
when
we could call certain things protected property, and that would say what we mean.
Now, this definition I've got in here is what the committee agreed on. the last meeting, this definition of protected property. And all I did under my other draft here, I used the same definition, except I just called it Class 1 property rather than protected property, and moved forest land from Class 1
to
Class 2.
You just substituted Class 1 property for protected property.
Now, we agreed here
on
page 11 that the criterion should be occupancy rather than adaptation for overnight lodging.
Yeah.
All right. So we're discarding the definition that we had in preliminary draft 2, where we defined building and went on to describe it as something adapted for overnight accommodation of persons. So what we're doing, in effect, as I see it, based upon the discussions that we've had, by including structure, place, or thing, and using occupancy as a criterion, we're including aircraft and railroad cars, and, assuming they're passenger cars, we're including automobiles, boats. Now, I think that should be made clear, because that's obviously the intent of the draft. Now, do you have a question with respect to that, Dave? You want to enlarge on that, Don?
Well, it was certainly my impression that this was the intent and the spirit of the discussion of the subcommittee at the last meeting.
Well, I see that now. I just want to put a little heat on it, so you don't do something too quickly here. But, in other words, what, Class 1 property has just been substituted for protected property, hasn't it?
Well, there's no difference.
No difference, really. Okay.
In fact, the only difference is the use of Class 1 rather than protected property.
Yeah. Well, in fact, probably that's what we're searching for.
And the removal of forest land from protected property.
Now, I'm arguing a bit about this forest land. I see forest land as something that can be occupied by people.
Well, do you
think it isn't a structure, but it's certainly, when you said forest fire, you certainly very likely endangered someone.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't, but forest land wouldn't come within the definition of structure, place,
no,
or thing.
No, it couldn't be in structure, but.
But we could include it together with public buildings if we feel there's a sufficiently compelling public policy to include forest land or to prescribe forest fires with the highest degree of proscription. Agreed on?
Well, yeah, and then I think we should keep in mind too that if he sets fire to forest land and in so doing endangers the life of another person, that that's going to be first degree arson anyway under Section 5 of the draft.
Let's see. By starting with our cousin.
Under sub 2.
Well, it just not automatically makes it first degree arson.
If there are people endangered, it doesn't matter what kind of property it is.
First degree,
if he intentionally sets a fire.
So you have to prove, in this case, that this forest fire was set, the forest didn't contain people and that they were in danger. Yeah.
Now, presently, forest fires are not proscribed specifically by the arson.
Except that they would come under. They would come under. Arson in the third degree. They do forest fires, and plus there's under the chapter on forests, there's a specific statutory prohibition against setting fire to forest. But even without that, it would be punishable as third degree arson under 164040, which sets fire to or burns property of any class or character. it would fall within the definition of property of any class or character. So it is first degree arson, or third degree arson under our present statute.
Now, let's take the case of the fellow who drives through the forest and he throws a cigarette out. That's an intentional act. Distinguished from putting it in his ashtray. And so he's just about to be used of arson in the first degree. He doesn't intentionally damage Class 1 property or any property. He recklessly places another person in danger of bodily injury in Class 1 property or other injury or damage. Are we making that first degree arson?
Well, I don't think so. I think that in a hypothetical like that, it would be a question of what the man's intent was. You'd have to be in a position to prove that he intentionally set the fire. And if a man throws a cigarette out of his window, it seems to me it'd be more likely to be negligent burning.
Careless act. Reckless.
Well,
because you're going to have to be in a position to prove the intentional burning.
Here's a question that I have. If we want to make first degree arson the highest or the most serious offense, and our primary concern should be to protect people. And I think we also should place a high premium on things like state buildings and libraries and museums and meeting halls and churches and things like that. So that pricing should be included in there. Now, you have Section 2 in first degree arson. A provision that if a person starts a fire on any property and it recklessly places another person in danger, then that should be first degree arson too, which is like somebody burns down a barn and the farmer's in there asleep. State would prove that the man is in there sleeping and this act recklessly placed him in danger, bodily injury, ergo first degree arson. The problem that I have, and we've been over this, is simply this. I think that subsection sufficiently protects people to the extent that I'm wondering if we don't get into a difficult area by the broad use of phrase, structure, place, or thing customarily occupied by people. Vis-a-vis, somebody burns my boat. I'm not in it. I pretend I customarily occupy it. Ergo, first degree arson, burning my 18-foot pleasure craft. Somebody burns my car. I'm not in it. Doesn't place me in danger. But the state says, well, you customarily occupy that. Now, we get down to the question of the definition of occupancy. Do we hit a snag?
Would that be a jury question on the lesser included crime and tell me as to whether this was something that was customarily occupied? If you find the lesser included second degree, I would think under those circumstances.
Well, Maybe so.
I think what we're trying to say, is that we're talking about property that as a class is customarily occupied rather than specific individual property being customarily occupied. I don't think that at least the intent of this draft, and my understanding of the intent of the subcommittee was not that the state would have to show, say, that your boat was customarily somebody else, but it was of the type of property that would be customarily occupied, which would have the effect of putting the actor on notice. There would be the kind of property that would be likely to have people in it.
A car, an unoccupied car, is about as likely to have people in it as an unoccupied house. Or as a house.
Now, wait a minute. An unoccupied car.
Well, no, a car that, let's say it isn't occupied, but you set a fire a house or a car, either one. And you aren't certain whether someone's in it or not. One is as likely to have someone in it as the other.
It's a little bit easier to tell if somebody's in the car.
It's easier, but there could easily be someone asleep in the back seat or something like that. You can set the downtown thing on fire very easily without knowing they're there.
But what about a wrecked car? What about if somebody goes down to the Sisters Oregon public dump and there's a car, there's a 1952 DeSoto out there, and somebody throws a match in the gas tank, burns it up. The owner of the dump comes running in, they want an indictment for first degree arson.
You can't tell. San Fernando Red may be sleeping in there.
Well, should the determination that we make with respect to policy go towards the protection of that old car for first degree arson, or should it go towards the protection of life?
Well, I think what we're trying to get is the protection of life,
yeah,
but
right.
At the same time, you have to have a statute that I think is fair on its face, and that is that I think it would be unreasonable to, under those circumstances, although there would be maybe some other crime that he might be charged with, for example, under the Model Penal Code assault provisions, for example, that might come under somebody's injured as a result of reckless conduct like that. But I don't think we envision that, do we, as being arson.
We don't, but there's certainly the probability exists that if you set an old car fire or you set a new car fire, there is a probability, although shaded, it's very degrees of shading, that someone could be in there.
But I
am the same as with a house. A house that's, I don't suppose that anybody would really be convicted of arson, would they, if they set one of those abandoned shacks afire out in eastern Oregon. But nevertheless, I think the law, the way it reads right now, would call it arson. And so, sure, there are various shadings in here, but we can't be too troubled by that, can we, when we draft the law?
No, except that I think we can anticipate maybe what a court's likely to do, say, under this draft. It seems pretty unlikely to me that you could get a instruction from the court that would tell the jury that an abandoned car is the kind of property that's customarily occupied by people.
Well, how about an abandoned house? It's obviously abandoned. Is that the same situation?
Well, no, I don't think so. I think a house is certainly a much closer question, because a house is designed primarily for human occupancy.
Cars are designed for people.
Is occupancy the thing that's troubling us? I look back at your earlier draft, and maybe you're right. On the earlier draft, where you say any structure, place, or thing adapted for overnight accommodation of persons, or structure, place, or thing occupied by any, or customarily occupied by any person lodging therein.
I think we
plowed that down pretty well.
Yeah, we did plow it, and of course, I was trying to limit the...
You were trying initially to limit it.
Yeah.
But now, if you're going to... unplow the ground. You see? See, what were the objections to that? We went over that pretty
well. Well, we had the initial objection at the first meeting was, the first thing that came up was Bob Chadwick thought, well, hell, if you're going to include a boat and a car, you ought to include an aircraft.
Right.
All right. And then we had the last meeting that brought up the subject of a railroad car.
Right.
And then we decided that rather than use language adapted for overnight accommodation of persons, that we should say customarily occupied by persons. But we ultimately reached the policy determination that protection of life should be the number one criterion for first degree arson. And Don has very accurately covered that with subsection 2 of section 5.
In which
sense? By saying that if you damage any property and the act recklessly places another person in danger of bodily injury, then it's first degree arson. Let me say this. The way you drafted this is sufficiently acceptable to me that I'll pass it out, or I'll agree if the others are agreeable to doing it. But I'm not sure. I'm not completely convinced that you were more right the first time now that they were.
Why did we put the occupancy test in there at all?
Well, I think we've got to have some kind of test.
Yeah.
And although I don't think these later drafts make the test as precise as the earlier ones, it's a question of what we're trying to do.
You mentioned your car. You know, I drove from Bend to Salem this morning and I saw three cars stop along the road. Two of them obviously had people sleeping in. And one, I couldn't see him.
But if anybody started a fire there, they'd be chargeable with first degree arson.
Yeah, that's what we want.
All right.
I think that's what we're talking about.
And there's no question. But that if the way it is right now, if there was nobody in those cars and somebody fired them up, it'd still be first degree arson. Even though the car might be worth $500 or $1,000.
Not in the present sense you're talking about.
No, under the proposed 3 and 3A.
Oh, yeah.
If there was nobody in those cars and somebody fired them up, started firing,
I think it should be, that's right.
They'd be first degree arson, whereas you might have a $30,000 barn on your place. Somebody burns it up, and it's second. Or a $50,000 field of food. And yet I'm not saying that the barn shouldn't be second degree arson. It should be. It doesn't endanger people.
Yeah.
If burning up a car doesn't endanger people, there's no reason in the world for making that offense. But making that offense of the same high premium as an offense of endangering a person's life.
Now, on your hypothetical about burning this car with somebody in it. Now, under the draft, if the defendant intentionally sets fire to this car, and he doesn't kill the occupant or the passenger in this car, whoever's in there, he's going to be guilty of first degree arson nonetheless, because he's endangered that person. But under present Oregon law, he's not going to be guilty of arson. At least the first degree arson. If he kills this person, it'd be felony murder.
Yeah.
Because it would be arson under the present law. If the person's killed, but if the person's been injured, it's not going to make it any more serious. It's not going to increase the severity of arson. It would still be third degree arson under our present law. The way I read it, it'd be third degree arson, property of any class or character. So, actually, these drafts write in more protection. I mean, it's a stiffer provision than what we have now.
Well,
from that standpoint,
even if this were changed to adaptation for overnight property, it would be stiffer.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, much stiffer.
Yeah, because even if we don't have any definition of protected property in our draft, we're still going to have it. It's still going to be first degree arson under Section 5.
If it endangers the person. I think, frankly, that you had the right idea in the beginning that if it endangers a person's life, it should be first degree property or first degree arson. If it's a dwelling type structure, it should be first degree arson because this is a place that's customarily occupied or people lodging therein. Or if it's the burning of a public building, it should be first degree arson. But what do you think, Dave?
Well, I'm in trouble. This catch-all of the 3.8, I should say 5.2, say any property, whether he's owner or another, in such act recklessly placed on the person in danger. Some way we get the person who's in danger in the class of property and here. Or put the burden on the man or the arsonist to look and see if he's there.
Well, really, that's what we were attempting to do. I'm not sure we succeeded, but we were attempting to do that. By the way, we define protected property customarily occupied by people. We weren't going to require the state to prove, or to have to prove, as the New York Code does, as Michigan requires, that not only was there somebody in that building, but that the defendant knew it, or had good reason to know it. We felt that was requiring too great a burden for the state to maintain, and that if it's the kind that's customarily occupied, we weren't going to require actual knowledge on the part of the or actually requiring the state to prove that somebody was in that building. In other words, it would still be first degree arson under our definition. It might have been a vacant building, but if it was the kind that was customarily occupied, it would nonetheless still be first degree. But at least that's what we were trying to do.
Barns are customarily occupied by people during certain hours of the day, let's say, healthy time. We'll fire up a barn when somebody's in there. That's first degree arson.
Supposing we make this change, adopting this language from the definition of dwelling house in the present Oregon law. Class 1 property means any structure, place, or thing customarily occupied by any person lodging therein. And public building is defined. And I want to tie down a little bit greater test for occupancy than just being there. Now this would do away with any possibility of charging the person first degree arson for burning the barn.
Yeah, we're getting away from our. If you do that, we're getting away from the principles we decided on the last meeting. That's going counter to what we talked about in protection of life.
No, it isn't.
I guess I don't understand your...
Well, we're going to protect life, Ed.
by sub 2 of section 5, if you burn anything, no matter what it is, a wheat field, a barn, a car, an airplane, a railroad car, no matter what it is, and that act endangers another person, that's first degree arson. And that's the criterion that it comes to.
That's one property. There's only going to be that customer occupied for overnight.
Reckless,
and then maybe you're hitting something. Well, if we use recklessly there, culpability element as opposed to the intentional. And some of the earlier meetings we discussed some of these culpability terms have not yet been decided upon by the commission, such as intentional, what we mean by intentional, and negligently and recklessly. Recklessly, as it's defined by the Model Penal Code, is pretty much consciously ignoring a known risk, substantially the way that the Model Penal Code defines recklessly. And we've proceeded on that basis that this is a higher type of culpability than negligence. After all, we're talking about a crime that's undoubtedly going to be one of the more serious felonies under the code. It's going to be arson, first degree arson.
He kind of lost me there on why we actually need recklessly, because he intentionally did this.
Well,
he intentionally places another person in danger of bodily injury.
No, he didn't. No, he intentionally damages the property. He starts a fire.
He intentionally damages the property. And such act places another person in
danger. Maybe he didn't intend it to place anybody in danger, and chances are he didn't. But if his act was such that it recklessly did this, then it's going to be first degree arson anyway. Now, this follows the reasoning of the Model Penal Code. They distinguish between an intent to damage the property and recklessly endangering somebody. They draw a distinction between the two. And I think there should be a distinction. Intentionally sets fire to the property, and maybe he did not intend to endanger anybody, but his conduct was so reckless in setting that fire intentionally that somebody is placed in danger. There's good policy reasons for making that first degree arson without proving that he intended the damage.
I said it once before, but I can't. Why don't we want to strike recklessly?
places in the first degree.
Well, then you may get into situations where maybe it wasn't the kind of conduct that even would come up to the degree of culpability that we define as reckless. You want to make the first degree of it just negligence. It's just a lesser kind of culpability. Got this intentionally up here. He's intentionally damaged property.
Never had a situation where you intentionally damaged property, but still have a crime.
Not like the cigarette, like that.
No, I mean, not from the damage. That'd be a negative situation.
Well, let's.
Field burning situation or something like that.
Yeah, now that's why we had the section on negligent burning.
Yeah, but say you had a situation where burning a field, they reason to believe there's a bunch of wino sleeping out in the field or something, or a bunch of Boy Scouts camped out there or something. Are we getting away from the crime?
Well, I don't think it would be covered under arson. That's the kind of situation that I think would be covered under assault, under the broad assault provisions of model penal codes, because they have a section called reckless endangering of a person, which is it's part of their assault article. I think that kind of situation would be covered. We have simple assault includes negligently causes bodily injury to another with a deadly weapon, or attempts or to cause or purposely, knowingly, or recklessly causes bodily injury to another. That's assault.
Yeah.
Of course, this is a lot different than our definition of assault that we have now. But it does, you can see a good reason for it, because it does take care of this kind of situation you mentioned, where if you recklessly cause an injury to another, you don't have to prove you intentionally injured somebody. If it's reckless injury, you can still convict you of simple assault, which would be...
It seemed to us at the last meeting that we should have some qualifying word in there. It's just not right. That's why you put recklessly in. You felt that it didn't require a high degree of proof as malicious or wanton. It's not true.
Yeah, and of course this is I'm not claiming this is an original thought on my part. I mean, these are senior books that we've set on some of the other texts of other states.
Well, it's right here in the Modern Penal Code. Recklessly placing another person in danger, death, or bodily injury. Recklessly placing a building or occupying structure of another in danger, damage, or destruction. But get to that in a minute. I've got it.
Under New York revised penal law, it's arson in the third degree to recklessly damage a building by intentionally starting a fire. So the intentional fire that wasn't But then in second degree, if he intentionally damages the building.
I think that we have to move. I've read these again, and I think the preliminary draft number 3 is better than 3A, simply because when you start talking about class 2 property, you bring in building,